Okay, we might try and make a start in the next minute or so. Just firstly, just double checking, everyone can hear me in the offices in Tokyo, Canberra, no one in Canberra, and Melbourne.
Sorry.
Hello.
Hello, how are you going?
Good, thank you. You can hear us. Melbourne?
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. If I could just ask each of the officers to stay on mute, please. Okay, we'll kick off. Welcome, everyone, to our third AJBCC Future Leaders Seminar. My name is Gerard Dooley, and I'm a Senior Associate in the MinterEllison M&A team and a member of the MinterEllison Japan Desk. I'm also an AJBCC Future Leaders member. Today, we have assembled a group of panellists that have contributed and are contributing a lot to the Australia-Japan relationship, but importantly, are doing so in very diverse ways, and so are excellently placed today to provide their thoughts on our seminar topic. Before I introduce the seminar and our panellists in more detail, I'd like to welcome all of you here in Sydney and via video conference in Melbourne, Canberra and Tokyo, and thank at the outset our hosts, MinterEllison in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra, and the Australian Embassy in Tokyo. Both MinterEllison and the Australian Embassy are long-term supporters of the AJBCC and the Future Leaders, and we thank them both for their continued and generous support and, of course, for the use of their facilities today. For those of you who may not be aware of the Future Leaders program, the AJBCC established the Future Leaders program in 2014 to support the development of the next generation of Australia-Japan business leaders. Building on the contributions of current and past leaders, and with the goal of maintaining the longevity and strength of the bilateral relationship over the longer term, the program has established a network of future leaders who participate actively within the AJBCC. Currently, the future leaders make active contributions to the annual conferences through the future leaders roundtables and the plenary sessions. In addition to these conference-focused activities, we also run a series of seminars, and today is the third of those seminars. And most recently, last year, we created a program that ran for the first time for mentors and mentees. We have 13 groups participating last year. So to today's seminar. The topic for today is Japan and Australia's evolving relationship. Lessons for disruptive times. Now, all of us here today know a lot about the relationship and the strength that we have in our relationship between Australia and Japan. But no relationship is without challenge. And right now, for Australia and Japan, those challenges are numerous. They arise from things around technological innovation, social change, and the political landscape. We've all seen the historic pictures this week coming out of Singapore with President Trump and Kim Jong-un, and this will no doubt have impacts for both Australia and Japan in the region going forward. So in these disrupted times, what can we as future business leaders do to take full advantage of this new environment? Do we need to fundamentally change our approach, or are there still valuable lessons to be learned from decades of past experience? And what impact are these issues having on people involved in business between Australia and Japan today? So to discuss these questions further, please let me briefly introduce today's panellists. Firstly, we have Kaoru Nishinakagawa. Kaoru-san grew up in Japan and moved to Australia 7 years ago, and early in her career worked in semiconductor and digital media industries. Following completion of her MBA here in Australia, she co-founded Innovation Dojo, which assists startups to enter the Japanese market and provide cross-cultural entrepreneurship programs for both young professionals and corporates. Recently, Kaoru-san published a white paper titled Accelerating Cross-Cultural Innovation Across Japan and Australia, which explains what could be considered and done to take the partnership that we have economically between the nations to the next level. Next, we have Jason Hayes. Jason is a leader of PwC's Japan business practice in the Asia region and is also a financial assurance partner based in Sydney. Jason worked at PwC's Tokyo office in Japan for a total of 8 years. Jason is a lead author of PwC's Japan Rebooted series and is a regular commentator in the media and presenter at forums on Japanese trade and investment in Australia. Next, we have, Ayumi Takaku. Ayumi-san came to Australia in 2014 seeking great opportunities for women in the workforce. Following completion of her Masters of Commerce in International Management, Ayumi's passion for nurturing the Australia-Japan relationship led her to work in a number of Australian high schools, where she aimed to bring light to the importance of being a bilingual professional. Currently, Ayumi-san is a business development coordinator at KPMG, where she supports Japanese companies to develop their businesses further in Australia. And finally, David Jacobs. David was appointed the CEO of the AWCC in 2015. David first travelled to Japan in 1969, where he quickly carved out a career in Australia-Japan business. Early in his career, David led a Japanese government office in Sydney for 10 years, the Australia-Japan Economic Institute. Following this, David established his own Japanese corporate advisory firm, where he has consulted with a wide variety of Australian companies working in Japan. In 2016, he received a commendation from Japan's Foreign Minister for his contribution to Australia-Japan relations. So today's seminar will be structured as a moderated Q&A session with our panellists. Our moderators will be Peter Radzik, at the end of the table there, and myself. Peter is also a Future Leaders Program member and research and project analyst at Grant Thornton. We'll also invite our audience across all locations to ask any questions they have at the end of our moderated session. And just as a reminder, today's session will also be recorded and uploaded on the AWCC website shortly after today's seminar. So let's dive straight in, and Carlos-san, I might start with you firstly. As I mentioned, you grew up in Japan before moving to Australia. Could you please tell us a bit more about your experience as a young professional who has moved from Japan to Australia?
Sure. So I moved here 7 years ago right after the earthquake. So it was a really tough year for me. 2011 was, earthquake happened in March, moved here in April. And that a lot of image I had for Australia in terms of people, like nature didn't betray me at all, like an amazing beach, great harbor, and then like national parks everywhere, people very friendly and open-minded, so I loved it. But the culture was a little bit surprised, like there is much more than I thought, like a coffee quality was really high. A lot of Australian friends in Japan kept telling me Australian coffee is great, but I was a little bit skeptical because I couldn't really tie the like in image. But yeah, it was really here, and restaurant quality is very high, and fintech was really advanced than more than I thought. No mobile payment and PayWave already existed here when we didn't have in Japan, so that was great. And in terms of work wise, I moved from Japan office to Australian office within same company. So I could see the difference very well. And I particularly spotted two main things. So Australian workers are a little bit more efficient and accepting. So let me elaborate on that. Like efficiency in terms of system and technology, Japan has very high, like a train state system, as you can imagine. I miss that, that great system. But I'm talking about day-to-day people operation efficiency is very high here because Australian people focus on important things without worrying about too much about many different scenarios. In Japan, people prepare for in case something happens. So we are just asked to think about different scenarios in advance, which might not be utilized later. So for example, when I was working for Getty Images, and one of our biggest clients was always advertising agency. They always ask us about the name of the image at the end of the corner of the image, like what's the name of the flower at the end of the images, which most likely will be edited out. But they need to know in case customer asks them. So that thought of activity was normal in Japan. That created more work. And in Australia, I think people just focus on what they need to do. If something happens, just quickly adapt and try to come up with a different solution. So it took me a while to get used to that style, but once I get used to it, I felt like I was a little bit more efficient that way. And also accepting-wise, like I was dealing with a lot of clients, consumer and business both in Japan and Australia. I rarely see Australian clients complain about things over and over and over, like a long term, which could actually happen in Japan more. And like people just, once we explain, yes, this is not going to happen because this, people accept it and move on. They try to come up with alternative solutions. So in my view, people are more valuing the time rather than just, that prefer to save time rather than just spending more time to get a small win. So that, I felt like that's how Australia got a fast pace. Business here, which is more likely, particularly in innovation area, which is very important.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carlson. Jason, we all know our friends at PwC put a lot of work into lots of reports in the past few years on the Australia-Japan relationship, economic and otherwise. What's your assessment of the current state of the relationship? What's big gaps or opportunities do you see, and what should we do about them?
Sure. Thanks, Peter. And hello, everybody, today. Fantastic opportunity to speak to you all. Well done to the future leaders for putting this event together. Look, I think, you know, without doubt, the current state of the relationship between Australia and Japan remains very strong. I think without doubt, Australia's relationship with Japan is the best in the region. We've got a very long-term relationship. Japan has helped build industries in Australia, which is something that we shouldn't lose sight of. But I guess when you have such a strong long-term relationship, it's something that you need to avoid the status quo being accepted, and you need to continue to work at the relationship. You know, I think Australia needs to do more with the relationship with Japan as it relates to, you know, future foreign direct investment into the country. And equally, we need to do a better job of the investment that we have in Japan itself. You know, it's embarrassing the number of Australian companies that currently have a business presence in Japan, and that's something that we absolutely need to work on. And I think there's a view there as to how we could actually move the needle forward to have a more substantive presence in the country. You know, in terms of the gaps in the relationship, well, look, you know, Japan's starting to, or continuing to move their plans forward to invest in sectors in Australia that they haven't historically invested into previously. I mean, Japan's investment portfolio here is all about resources, energy, financial services. But since probably around about 2010 onwards, we've seen Japan start to look at sectors in Australia, whether it be education, advertising, transportation, logistics, you know, wealth management, et cetera. And I think that's a start of a lot more interest to follow in a lot of other sectors as well. I know Herbert Smith Freehills put out a report at the start of the year that profiled about 28 M&A transactions coming into the country. And, you know, scrolling your eye down the list, it's wonderful to see that the new sectors that Japan is starting to invest in away from some of the more traditional. So ideally, to me, it's how do you nurture where Japan has invested historically, resources, energy, et cetera, and let's not lose sight of the importance of Japanese investment in that regard. How do we sort of shine the light on the fact that we do have, you know, sectors that are quite viable and will allow Japan to be able to achieve their plans to become more globalised, to enter into new markets? We do have a very strong economy. You know, Moody's this morning reaffirmed the rating of Australia as being AAA rating. How do we continue to tell Japan the story that we are a very attractive country to invest for all the right reasons? But then there's the next generation, you know, the emerging industries, the emerging sectors that we also need to start to sort of set the wheels in motion and do what we can to be able to attract investment from Japan into Australia in that regard. You know, Japan is still incredibly capital rich. Now, a recent report we put out, Peter, showed that the top 200 Japanese companies sit on about $2 trillion of cash. You know, about $3.6 trillion of retained earnings, no debt. I mean, it's a tremendously healthy set of financials that corporate Japan have. How do we try and direct some of that, a lot of that, towards the Australian market? That's the challenge, and I think it's a challenge that we can't just assume, you know, will be managed by, let's say, the government. I think it's got to be a collaborative effort. I think it requires us to sort of approach the relationship in a way in which we haven't before. And if we are able to come together and collaborate in a way in which it's attractive for Japan, I see them only accelerating their plans to do more in this market as well. So to me, great relationship. Let's not lose sight of the history of the relationship, but absolutely, there's a lot more excitement of things that we could be doing together. You know, that's just Japan coming into Australia. I mentioned before, there's an awful lot of Australian businesses that could be going into Japan. There is an approach that needs to be taken, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. It's not as easy as saying Japan's a big market, let's go and invest. We have to be quite specific about how we do that. But then even after that, there's the opportunity for us to be able to collaborate with Japan in third markets as well. So that's, I guess, another interesting discussion we could have possibly later on, Peter.
Thank you, Jason. Yumi-san, going back to a young Japanese professional coming into Australia, similar to Kato-san, I'd be interested to hear about your initial experiences here.
Sure.
And starting your career here.
Sure, thank you. So I also worked for a Japanese trading house in Japan before moving to Australia. I was for 5 years in Japan. So in that company, I learned a lot of Japanese protocols, such as how to communicate in the company, how to send an email, business email, how to report to boss, and even how to prepare tea for a meeting. And now I'm working in an Australian environment where the communication is very straightforward. And so these two different experiences in different corporations gives me, I learned a key notion of the difference of the two corporations. So Australia and Japan has developed a long relationship in economically, and both countries recognize each other as important business partner. But however, we still have difficulties when we do business together. We still have a mismatch of the understanding of the business culture. So I've been thinking, why? Why we are not still being able to close the gap? So there's a theory. Westerners were hunters and Japanese were farmers. So it's very simple. Westerners think about, the hunters think about tonight's dinner. So everything, the process is quick, short term, effective, and small group. Whereas for farmers, they need to think about and invest a lot of time to prepare for the long-lasting harvest in the future. So Japanese tend to think about long-term and prefer stability, and also like group, bigger group compared to Western people. So this fundamental understanding, I'm sure this connects the dots, why they behave as they do in the business practice. And with this understanding in mind, I'm pretty sure we can do business communication better and do the business better between Japan and Australia. And this was my biggest finding by working in Japan and Australia.
Very interesting. Thank you, Amy.
David, over to you now. The AJBCC, JABCC conference in October this year has its theme taking the long view. And as Aimi-san has told us, Japanese companies seem to prefer this as pharma originating. In the current environment of disruption and pace, will this taking long view alter in any way?
Great. Thanks, Peter. It's an excellent segue from what Aimi has just said. Let me just briefly explain in this year's conference, Taking the Long View, which the overall theme was actually developed by our Future Leaders Group, which I think is fantastic. In this era of huge turmoil and disruption, both politically, economically, and also in terms of regional security, there's lots of things, lots of balls in the air, and lots of things going on. And as many of you will know, the Japanese view, the traditional Japanese view, is very, very long-term. And the typical Western view is 90-day cycle focused, I think would be a reasonable sort of explanation. And I just want to instance a few things about Japan and its long-term view. One is, maybe you're not aware, that Japan has the largest number of companies that exceed 100 years of continuous operation in the world. And this is quite dramatic. And the second thing is that if we compare this, for example, say let's look at America, you could look at Forbes, there are a number of studies that have looked at this, or the Dow. For the Dow, there's only five companies that still are maintained currently. And one excellent example, which started the Dow right at the beginning, is General Electric. But there's only five companies that are currently. All the rest of them have been acquired, their names changed, they died, or whatever. And so typically, there are some figures about, you know, the average life of a company, of a listed company. And in the Western world, it I think typically is around sort of 30 to 40 years, something like that. The president of SoftBank, SoftBank is heavily into both IT and, and also robotics. Son is a really crazy brave president. He announced earlier this year that he is working on the corporate plan for SoftBank for the next 300 years. I found that was very difficult for me to get my head around. It was a bit like sort of, you know, some of these measurements of the galaxy. How do you get your head around a corporate plan of 300 years when the average working life of a person is 30/35 years? But this sort of, you know, yes, it's aspirational, but it just shows the difference probably, you know, in approach. And if we delve further into Japanese business sort of history or culture, the Omi merchants from the Edo period had a term called Sampo Yoshi, which was good in three directions, sort of. And good in three directions, that sort of business philosophy was good for the buyer, good for the seller, good for society. These are very lofty and aspirational concepts. So in answering the question in terms of, you know, in the current environment of disruption, will Japan be forced to change? I'd like to sort of spin this around and sort of say the challenge for Japan and also the challenge for us in terms of interacting with Japan and for the future leaders is to look at, you know, you don't want to lose the really good things. And there's a bunch of really good things that come out of the long view. And there's a bunch of really good things that come out of the short-term, you know, 90-day cycle. We don't want to lose them. What we want to work out is how can we adjust and get sort of both sides, or in the business transaction, how can you appreciate that this is where it's coming from, as Ayumi had instanced. And one of the things you may have seen, there are some analysis of Japanese companies which has sort of said, you know, Japan is basically, Japanese companies are in optimization mode and they're not in innovation mode, and this is causing an issue for them. And optimization, of course, is, you know, things like Kaizen, you know, continuous improvement. So we know how to make the bottle, so we're not going to make any other types of bottles, but we're just going to make a better and a better one. So it's a very sort of, in a sense, a very inward looking. If you come from an optimization philosophy, then it's not surprising that you come from a very, very process-driven culture. And Australians, while we understand process, I don't think we're particularly good at sort of keeping on the line in terms of process. We're not really process-driven. So I think for the future leaders, I think an awareness of these sort of two opposing forces and how you might be able to use them to your advantage, how you may be able to modify them, or how you may be able to reduce the frustration level that you might find in terms of bilateral business.
Thank you, David. Changing it around a bit and coming back to your mission and Bill's on innovation. Innovation is a word that we're all talking about, and for us lawyers, it's front of mind for us as well in the legal sector, although probably you're doing things very different to how we're doing things, but you're the co-founder of Innovation Dojo, and perhaps some people in the room here may not be aware of what exactly Innovation Dojo is. Can you tell us a bit more about what it is and how and why did you get started on that?
Sure, of course. So I met my co-founder, Joseph Wanali, who works for UNSW. He is a senior manager there for the accelerator program for startups. And once when we met, and we all have a common mission to connect Japan or Australia through different ways, like not based on the traditional way of connecting two countries. So both of us, he's working in innovation entrepreneurship space, and my focus during the MBA was innovation entrepreneurship. Let's try to do something around it. That's how we started Innovation Dojo together with Ayumi Mizushiri, who is an IT guy, but also serious entrepreneur. So we work together. There's so many things we want to do, but basically we want to establish an ecosystem where people can connect and just collaborate and do innovate together beyond that, like a country borderline and beyond the culture. So So that's what we basically want to do. There are so many ways to do it, and we started by providing the cross-cultural entrepreneurship program. So basically, we bring the Japanese university students or young professionals to Australia and match them with the same demography in Australia. So they need to make a mixed team. So some of the Australian students, some of the Japanese professionals, they have to work together and find the problem faced by both of the country and solve the problem together. So after the at the end of the 9 days, the winner can go to Japan and continue to work on their idea by meeting investors or like some potential partners. So that's the whole idea. Then I don't know if you ever heard of the VKI, where they were the one of our best graduates. So they pretty much came up with the idea to teach different language through VR. So in Asia, a lot of people who, like the English proficiency is very low, particularly in Japan, because people are scared to make mistake and they don't have an opportunity to speak English neither. So this VR concept will kind of prevent them from feeling like a scared to make mistakes, so because they're behind some kind of avatar type of things. That's kind of, they try to solve the problem or the mental blockness in Japan. So that type of good startup came up from a program, but we want to generate more of those. But same time, we want to develop global talent, so who can actually work with people from different backgrounds. So through this program, people get to, initially they're really, really anxious and uncomfortable working with people from different culture, but eventually they become really good friends. They really bounce each other well, and they're really happy at the end. So a lot of contestant participants come up to me sometimes, wow, this, I never have this experience, like some of the students from Tokodai, Tokyo Institute of Technology. So they say, like, oh, I never have this experience. Like, he's a very smart robotics engineer. Like, he's very smart, but he never had an opportunity to work with, like, English speaker like that, and he needs to come out from his shell. So that was really a great experience for them. That way we want to keep going to develop global talent in the way. But also another things we want to do more is bring out Australian startup and SME to Japan market. Obviously it's not easy, but Australia is a great country, but a market is not big. And a lot of government want to say about, oh, China, but it's good for the big company, but not really. It's really difficult for a small company to go into China. A lot of regulation is there, and they know Japan's there, but they try to avoid because they know the culture, it's not easy country to go into. They end up going to a lot of times Singapore and Hong Kong. It's great for testing market. It's English-speaking country. It's nothing wrong with it, but if they want to, like, hunt, like a bigger market, Japan shouldn't be ignored. So I won't say every company should go to Japan, but that should be the one of the options. But unfortunately, Australian startups never think about Japan to go into. And on the other hand, Japanese investors never think about Australia is a place to look for the startup neither. Even though investment activity in Japan is really growing, and last year, $3.3 billion people just scored as a startup just got funded from just all these investors. That number is growing every year. And as you know, SoftBank is now the largest venture capital in the world, $100 billion, all the backed by Saudi Arabian government. But look, Japan is going hunt the people. And they're looking outside of Japan more and more so, but why don't they look inside Australia a little bit more? So we try to pretty much connect the dot to just have another horizon, you know, just for them, like for Japan to invest in Australia potentially, and an Australian startup to go into Japan to either just expand the market or just get investment. So this overall, yes, those are trying to establish some system and a platform, so where everybody, just startup, corporate, and government can work together, and yeah, the place to connect together.
Thank you.
Well, and just to add to that as well, I mean, you know, from our perspective, when we look at the startup space across Australia, you know, we are a very innovative country. There is a very vibrant startup community that we have here, but our system is pretty much based on, you know, develop a new business model for application in this market. Mm-hmm. So when you think about, you know, who is actually trying to agitate towards application in other markets, Asian markets, Japanese markets, we kind of struggle to actually see anybody doing something substantive other than Innovation Dojo. So that's why we think what they're doing is absolutely fantastic and it's so important. It's kind of disappointing, to be honest, that there's not other organisations trying to do the same thing as well. Because if we're, you know, really trying to see these businesses succeed, it's foolish to think that the only place they're going to succeed is in the Australian market. You know, there is oftentimes some ideas that come out that in theory are probably better applied in a market like Japan than even in Australia as well. So absolutely applaud what you and the team are doing. So well done.
Thank you.
Thanks, Constantine. Jason, just going back to you quickly. You've alluded previously to the opportunities we can leverage in the Australia-Japan relationship that we've done in the recent past. How, given Innovation Dojo's work and wider in the Australia-Japan space, how will Australian businesses, or how will we as a group, be able to strengthen the relationship further, and in what ways will we be able to?
Good question. I thought you were going to ask something different then. So, look, I think I think where we're at is that, you know, as a country, we are a exporter of products and services. We are absolutely an importer of capital. You know, the strength of the Australian economy, to a degree, has been benefited from a strong inflow of capital from other markets. And, you know, Japan and China clearly are two countries that are contributing to that. I still marvel when I ask the question, you know, who is the largest current contributor of FDI into this country? The number of people, whether it's the public, government, corporates, advisors, say, oh, it's China. And you go, well, actually, they're not number one. Who do you think's number two? Well, they're not number one. They must be number two. But, you know, you eventually get them down to number six and you go, oh, wow, China's number six, right? So who is number one? Must be the US or the UK. And we'll say, well, the current number one for FDI is Japan. Yeah, and last few years by a considerable margin. I think it was 2015-16. You know, Japan's investment was 50% more than the US. It is the largest cumulative investor into this country, and three times more than that from China. So that's quite remarkable, and I keep telling that story because I think more and more people need to appreciate that Japan is incredibly important to the ongoing inflow of capital into this market, and we are very reliant on that capital. You know, my view is, if we can find the way in which we can continue to nurture that flow of capital into the country, we'll continue to benefit as a consequence. As opposed to, if we lose sight of the absolute benefits that investment from Japan brings to our country, and we are distracted by investment from other countries who approach investment in foreign markets in a very different manner, is that good? Question. You know, if you look at the different ways in which Japan and China, for example, invest, you know, Japan often silent investors or minority stakeholders, but more often than not, if Japan does buy a business, plenty of examples, you know, Lion, Dairy Farmers, Japan Post acquisition of Toll, Nippon Life's acquisition of MLC's wealth management business, they absolutely respect Australian workforce and Australian management teams. Can't say the same about some of our other foreign investors that come into this country who take a very different approach, you know, swallow up, bring their own sort of management team through, and we then sit back and wonder what's going to happen next. So I do sort of have a strong preference towards the way in which Japanese approach their investment into the market. You know, Australia is paying attention to the opportunities and the benefits that has been closely tied to our favourite neighbour like Japan. And some examples have included the innovation science, technology, and memorandum of cooperation that the two prime ministers entered into a couple of years ago. You know, last year they entered into a memorandum to cooperate in the area of sport. So great ideas, a view there that we would benefit if we collaborated in each of those areas. Now, I mentioned before that innovation is sort of slowly moving forward thanks to the good work at Innovation Dojo. Sport, you know, there's a tremendous amount of interest, but the follow through and the substantive progress is sort of yet to follow. So my view is, we actually need to do more to be able to bring these things together. So if we've identified an area, and let's say it's sport, we do need to take a collaborative approach and not just rely on government to sort of figure things out and make things happen. You know, we, corporates, academics, sporting organisations all need to come together and understand the knowledge base that we have about working with one another is actually quite strong. There is a way in which we can move things forward that will benefit us both in the short and the long term, but it's a combination effort. I don't think it's necessarily going to be solved by one organisation or one individual. I think it requires a different approach, a different way of thinking. And if we can bring more people together, I think, you know, not only with the sports opportunity, the innovation opportunity, I think the opportunities in third markets like Southeast Asia, we can be that much more successful, as well as helping Japan be that much more successful in these opportune areas as a consequence.
Thanks, Jason. Imi-san, back to you. So there's a lot happening in this space. There's a lot of things happening between Australia and Japan. As a future leader, what challenges do you think we are facing in this relationship, and what can we try and do to overcome some of those challenges?
I think that the challenge for us is continuity. As David mentioned, there is a good thing about Japanese long-term business practice, and also there's good things about Australian short-term business practice, and how we can bring it together and how we can deliver to the future generation. And that's the main challenge. And also, in terms of the talent, we need to keep the pool of skilled people and talented people who really understand deeply between Japan and Australian business. And we need to keep those talents to the future. So in order to overcome this challenge, I think the key is education. Education includes the learning from the current leaders like Jason, David, and from similar groups like Innovation Dojo, and also the learning from all of you, like this seminar, and also other member future leaders within and outside of the future leaders group. So everyone's busy, but we need to keep this things happening, always keep in mind that we have to deliver the value of Japan-Australian business relationship, because there is an opportunity, and it is an important relationship, as Jason mentioned. So the challenge is how we can continue this mindset to next generation. And also, for example, I sometimes give presentation within KPMG, and so that to try to teach Australian professionals to understand Japanese working culture. Because sometimes they say, I know already, I know how to exchange business cards, I know we have to bow. But not only that, there is something deep inside what Japanese business person motto is not really understood by Australian professionals. So by doing so, they start seeing the clear, the real value between Japan and Australian business, and they start thinking with that bias or with that stereotype. And now the project goes smoothly, the business goes smoothly with that bias and stereotype. So I think education, keeping educated people, how important Japan-Australian economy and how important to continue this momentum is the key issue for the future.
Thanks, Imi-san. Dave, if I can turn to you. In the flyer, we asked the question, in these disruptive times, what can we future leaders do to leverage and take full advantage of this new environment? Do we need to do things differently, or are there still things we can learn from the past that we should be drawing on? What's your view on that?
Well, I'm going to take a devil's advocate position here, in that I don't think we need a new approach at all. I'd like to quote from Steve Jobs, where he said, you can't connect the dots looking forward, you can only connect them looking backwards. I'm a history buff, by the way. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. And I think that's, you know, it's a really interesting sort of observation. But, you know, let's look at it. Disruption is not new. Disruption has been occurring for hundreds, thousands of years, right? What is new currently is, I guess, a couple of things. One is disruption, or the term disruption, is appearing much more frequently. We're getting more activity because economies are more developed and advanced, the information age, et cetera, et cetera. But disruption itself as an animal has occurred since the year dot. So therefore, I'm going to argue today that we don't need a new way of looking at it. Let's just have a look at startups, for example, as a particular instance, because startups are all in the news and they're tagged and associated with disruption. And again, there's a difference between, I think, our perception or even the public perception. Public perception, in a nutshell, is I just set up a startup and, you know, within 12 months or 18 months, you know, I've bought my harbourside mansion, I've got my magnificent cruiser, and so it goes on, right? Where do we get that from? We get that from, I believe, from the fact that whenever we read or hear about innovative companies, we hear about market capitalization. And the market capitalization is always in, even for a very small company, is always in billions. And we think, wow, and we think that that must be equate to wealth, or wealth for the owners. Now, I went back and had a look at some of our really successful, inverted commas, startups. And I think you'll be amazed that many of those successful startups, let me give you, you know, a classic example of Atlassian. Atlassian, I think, has been going for 14 years. It only IPO'd, I think, was it 2 years, a year and a half ago, right? And if you go and you look at venture business and you look at the league table of Australian startups, you'll find the ones that probably you know as a household word have been going sort of, you know, on average about 7 years or something like that. So in fact, you know, there's this contradiction between we've got Japan and the long term, the long view, and we've actually got startups which seem like they're short, but they're actually pretty long. And so I think that there is a sort of a, we have to sort of step back and look at the framework. And what we can say about startups is that 30 years ago, or when, for example, Amazon set up, there wasn't actually any pathway as such, defined pathway or framework. Or when Jobs set up Apple, you know, the apocryphal story of maxed out his credit card and, you know, worked in a garage and all the rest of it. Those days are gone. You know, it's like Getty Oil. Those days are gone. We now have a framework and a structure where if you want to set up a startup, you know, there is a mechanism. You have to get funded. There are rounds of funding which are all set out. There's, you know, almost the hymn book of who you need to go to. So what we've done is I shouldn't use the word institutionalised, but in a sense, we've institutionalised a process of how to cultivate startups, which didn't exist before. So just apropos Ayumi's earlier comments and my earlier comments about the differences between Australia and Japan, the one thing which occurred to me when I look at sort of our history of business is complementarity. You've probably heard this a million times, but complementarity in terms of the bilateral relationship has been the cornerstone. We had the resources, you know, we shipped the resources to Japan, they turned them into manufactured products and they shipped it back to us, you know, and the same thing with commodities. That complementarity. And if you go through our relationship, there are many areas of complementarity. And, you know, just to give you a really simple one, which is geographical, they're in the northern hemisphere, we're in the southern. So, you know, there's all those opportunities which don't exist for other countries. So that issue of complementarity, if I can weave another thing into this, which is the long view and the short term, or as I mentioned earlier about innovation and optimization, then, I mean, that's great complementarity in a sense. We've got a partner who is an optimizer, and, you know, I believe, you know, Australia has got a track record in innovation in a number of areas. We may not be innovative over the full gamut, but we certainly have, you know, we've produced wireless Wi-Fi, we've developed Wi-Fi up, et cetera, et cetera. So complementarity, how can we, or how can you as future leaders, you know, how can you reflect on this and how can you bring your Australian and Japanese business relationship to A, appreciate that, and also appreciate, you know, we want a bit of this optimization because we like that, the way that that works, that does give benefits, and why don't you have a look at a little bit of our innovation and sort of, you know, work outside the square sometimes. But I think it comes back to Ayumi's concept of how we can explain better to our management, and I think that as future leaders, that's your role.
Okay, thanks, David. Carlos-san, this goes really, my question to you goes quite nicely from David. First, you've mentioned it on many occasions we've met previously that you want to focus, that Innovation Dojo focuses on cross-cultural innovation between Australia and Japan. Could expand a little bit on that. And one more question, if I could allow myself, what do you think we could do more or do better in Australia to help foster the innovative environment?
Sure. So it is proven fact that more diversity improves the success rate of innovation. So why don't we work together across the border? And we already have economic partnership and a long-term friendship underneath. It should be easier to work on top of it. So obviously we are looking at Australia and Japan now. It doesn't mean we're going to finish there. So eventually, yes, we want to have the first success there, but if there's opportunity to expand into, why don't we just connect all the JAPAC region? So obviously there's a lot of opportunity in Southeast Asia, so we are not really stopping only Japan, Australia, and maybe we have a lot of love call from India as well, so they really love what we are doing, so they want to be part of us, so why not? So we eventually want to connect, but it's always a cross-cultural aspect, not going to go away. So I'm going to come back to this later after I explain a little bit about this Australia, how we can just increase the more innovation in Australia. It's a really big theme, and I don't want to take any responsibility for this, but in my view, I like to dissect into different layers for this. So I always like to use this 4C pyramid theory for innovation. So usually it's built from the context on the bottom and culture on top of it, and the capability comes, and then finally collaboration. So collaboration bit is somewhere we want to get to, and that's really related to cross-cultural innovation as well. So context is basically about a policy or just education or system there. Yeah, I think the education in Australia is doing well. Like already, like sometime in some high school already teaching innovation program, like let them understand how you should think about a problem in the market and then try to solve the problem, which is great. And some of the company called Generation Entrepreneur, they always provide a hackathon for the high school students. So give them a lot of opportunity to expand, like to be a little bit entrepreneur. So education space, yes, and of course university, like they're competing to be the best in a university accelerator program. So it's not really happening. They're going to keep doing it. It's great. And policy-wise, they try to change. Of course, you have to start from somewhere. I hear a lot of people say, oh, Australia is so slow and this and that, but you have to start from somewhere. This, in my view, compared to 7 years ago when I moved here, Australia moves really rapidly and it really completely moved up. So for that, a policy, yeah, I won't touch up on that too much, but it's changing. But yeah, also system-wise, it's really moving like an accelerator, startup hub. Sydney startup hub is built in Wynyard, and a lot of accelerators everywhere, and a lot of incubators going around. But maybe investor, like investment, maybe might be difficult to increase amount right away in Australia. For that, again, like why don't you look into the Japanese cash, like you mentioned, or even we discussed around the corporate roundtable too. Australia got a number four, fourth largest pension fund as well. So can we just utilize some of them too? Who knows? But we have to look into more investment in terms of that another just part of the context. But I think next phase, like culture-wise, Australia already open-minded to this, more like willing to take challenge. I'm talking more compared to Japan, but like Australia still got a really open-mindedness. And I think that people who talk about innovation in startup, and as much the penetration ratio of this term is much higher in Australia. I see that every day in the news, and I hear that from the government. I hear that from the a business people. I even hear that from SME. So, which is good as a culture, why they know what it is, and they are not scared of it. Like in Japan, certain area, people talk about it. But if I speak to some of the executive of a Japanese company here and in Japan, what's innovation? Why do we have to work with startups? So the culture-wise, Japan have a lot way to go, but like Australia, culture-wise, I think it's not too bad. And Sydney was ranked in one of the best startup city in the world. So the culture was good. And the capability piece, I think it's easy to learn innovation theory, and it's easy to learn the innovation like a framework. It's just you need to learn it, but it's more likely, and STEM education is one of the topic. Technology is just the enabler. It just shouldn't be the goal. Like you have to find the problem, and technology will help you to solve the problem. By saying that, but technology is definitely is inevitable in this world. And obviously, prime ministers and all the this Austrian government is really focusing on STEM education, particularly for women, and which is have to happen more, and which is great, I think, activities. But if it's not, you might need to import people from outside as a really relevant talent as well, ongoing. And last bit, and we as a dojo want to focus on is, again, communication bit. So it just, again, going to the collaboration stage, you need to be able to communicate effectively across the border or across the cultural difference, even inside Australia or outside Australia as well. So that's something we take it lightly sometimes, and Australia is a very multicultural country. But if those people raised in Australia, obviously it's got a more like cohesive way of thinking. And if you just, and as Australia startup, you have to think about going outside Australia as soon as you start the company, because the market is not that big. And that time, so if you just understand how to communicate with the people, like if maybe from different countries, really helps them to be able to get to the level later. So yeah, for overall, Australia have to focus on some bit, like an investment particularly, and a culture bit. It's more about, not so much culture, but a capability-wise, a communication skill, and an understanding of a different culture. And yeah, because that's going to help them to be global as soon as possible. Yeah.
Thank you, Kata-san. Jason, I'll ask you to try and connect some of the dots on your career. And if you're reflecting back on your career, is there a key lesson or a piece of advice that sort of comes back to you that you'd like to perhaps pass on to us here today? Young business people are looking to develop and create their career with Australia and Japan.
Well, your career is still going.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Don't fret. As is your father. Maybe give me, I might give two responses to the question.
Sure.
Just listening to Mr. Nakagawa-san, sorry?
Yeah, we can choose which one you want.
Thank you, Bob. Actually, I was going to give two, but now I'll just give one because Bob was the other one. But anyway, just going off from what Mr. Nakagawa-san, Takako-san saying, and also what David's saying as well, look, I think if I was to rewind and do it again, right, I mean, I joined the firm in 1991 as a very excited sort of young professional wanting to make an impact, all things sort of Japan, Australia. But, you know, my learnings really didn't come to the fore until about 2005, sort of first year after my first year in Japan. And to me, if I was able to do it again, I'd like to accelerate the knowledge and the learnings of the story of the relationship back to the beginning so that I could do much more in my role and to contribute more to the relationship. So I think you've heard parts of it, right? You've heard the story of Japan capital rich. You've heard the story of Australia having some great innovation. But I don't think we tell the story enough in a very wholesome way. You know, if you think about how Japan approaches M&A, right? They've got the world, what I describe as the world's longest M&A checklist. And until they tick off every single box on that checklist, nothing happens, right? So how do you get them to get through that checklist much, much faster, right? And how do you actually educate them along the way? So if you are telling Japanese investors that have never come here before, we've got such a healthy economy, right? Didn't skip a beat with the GFC. You know, that not all of our economy is resources. 70% of our economy is services. If you talk about the high GDP per capita, if you continue to tell all the stories, right, we don't have Brexit, we don't have terrorism, we don't have Trump, right? The cost of education in Australia is not as expensive as it is in the US or Canada, right? If you tell all of these sort of really important points to Japan and also to ourselves, I think, you know, equally we need to be much more educated, as I say, about our relationship with Japan. My hope is that we can accelerate the relationship and take it forward much faster and much more wholesome. So that's the one, right? Tell the story, tell it proud. There's a lot there that needs to be understood and needs to be known. And we can't forget the Japan story. Yeah, every time I ask that question, who's the biggest investor in the country, and I hear China, oh, right, only so many times I can be stabbed in the heart. One day I'll hear someone go, it's Japan, and did you know? And I'll go, wow, this is great. And that's what I want you to do, right? I mean, the future leaders need to be empowered to do that. So that's one, the knowledge and the story. The second one is around the approach, right? And we've touched on the sort of the cultural aspects. You know, to me, you've got to approach the relationship with your eyes open and a willingness to learn. Because more often than not, we approach with an unconscious bias of it's either wrong or right. And I think if you are in that mindset of approaching, you know, a relationship or approaching a journey where your mindset is it's either wrong or it's right, and if I don't understand it, it's wrong, and therefore I'm just going to stop there, good luck, right? You may as well give up now. But if you have a mindset of being quite open to learning from somebody else and understanding that things are different for a very good reason, you know, Japan as a country, their number one priority is the country. You know, Australia, our number one priority is ourselves. That's a fundamental difference. But there's a reason why. Understand the reason and you're enlightened. Yeah? So that cultural awareness, I think, is so critically important. And unfortunately, we are, as a country, Australia, Japan, Singapore, the US, the UK, I'll keep going, culturally incompetent. Right? And I'll use that word incompetent. As it relates to culture, we are. Because none of us have gone through life, school, university, etc., being taught about that topic of culture. So therefore, we aren't experts in each other's culture. The only way you're going to be able to learn about it is to actually engage in conversation. Teach me about your culture, I'll teach me about your my culture, and net will actually be better as a consequence. So I think mindset as to how you engage, but also being, you know, proud enough and willing to tell that story, because it's a great story.
Peter, maybe we have one more question, then we'll turn to the audience.
Zoo, if we could ask on indulgence, a question of the entire panel. It goes to approach that Jason was mentioning earlier. We've heard from David the macro approach on taking the long view, and Jason's just mentioned as well on the macro view of approaching the relationship. But I'd like to ask the entire panel, starting with Jason, on the approach that Australian business should take towards Japan. What have they been doing wrong? What can they do right to expand further? So we don't see much foreign investment going into Japan, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, but from Japan a lot coming in. So how can we balance that a little bit?
Sure. So quick question, who's the last Australian business to go into Japan? Anyone want to guess? Any foodies in the room? Close to Domino's, but more modern day version.
Maybe someone's
restaurant? Close, yep.
Yeah, not Luke
Mangan. No. Apollo? Guzman Gomez. Last Australian business to go into Japan. The one before that, I think I'm correct. MuzzBuzz. Anyone heard of MuzzBuzz? Drive-through coffee. Came out of Perth. Last two businesses to go into Japan, right? Remarkable. I think in total, Bob, there's 34 Australian businesses in Japan. We've got more businesses in Kazakhstan than Japan, right? What does that mean? Does that mean that we are not interested in investing into overseas markets? No, we are. Does it mean that we've got a long track record of being able to successfully invest into overseas markets in like Japan? No, we don't. So I think we need to call it out. I think we need to say corporate Australia, opportune markets exist in Asia such as Japan. Don't go it alone. right? Because you don't have a track record of being successful. As a consequence, I think you need to approach it differently. You know, if you think of the wealth of knowledge that exists in this room, there's a, probably a hot spot here and a hot spot here of knowledge. And if you're able to tap into that and leverage the stakeholder community that exists to help you go into a market like Japan, I think as a consequence, you're going to be that much more successful. Yeah, unfortunately, we've got a history of sort of going it alone. If I'm going to do it, I'll do it by myself. I'm not going to engage with others. She'll be right. I've got that individualistic sort of mindset. I don't think that's going to work in a market like Japan. It's complex and sophisticated, absolutely. It's opportune, off the chart. It's very wealthy. Even 0.5% of that market probably equates to more revenue than what you could generate in Australia. But if you approach it intelligently and you go to that stakeholder group, you know, people like the Chamber of Commerce representatives in Japan, the Austrade guys up in Tokyo and the embassy, the DFAT guys, if you go to the academics that are there, are here, if you go to our diaspora, I mean, if you look at the brands that exist in Japan like Nike, BMW, Volvo, Citigroup, the list goes on, they're run by Australians, right? Very talented individuals running very big brands. If you could tap into that stakeholder group, you will be that much more successful entering into the market. So my message to Australian businesses, please don't go it alone. Please do it, but please embrace the stakeholder community because you'll get there that much faster and you'll stay for the long term.
Thank you, Jason. I understand your thoughts as a KPMG Global Japan business person. What approach can Australian business do in Japan to succeed?
Sure. I think one of the biggest problem is a lack of understanding for the Japanese market. So Australian people tend to think Japan's economy is stagnant, aging population, which is true, but Japan has over 100 million population, even only in Tokyo, 10 million people. Such a big market, and we are very, very much a consumer market. So if we bring the product, there are consumers, 10 million consumers in Tokyo. But just because of the lack of understanding, they think it's difficult or the economics not good for the market. But there is a market. We just need to understand, and we just need to understand the protocols, how we can do the business in Japan. And I think that's the problem of the Australian business.
David, your thoughts. What are Australian businesses doing right? What are they doing wrong? What could they do better?
this has been a perennial problem. And one of the things is that Japan falls off the list for some of the attributes that Ayumi has mentioned in terms of any analysis. You know, it falls at the first hurdle, which is it a growth market? No. Is there a language problem? Yes. And so you go on. So that's a sort of a bit of a given. So that's why it doesn't make the cut, number one. Number two, basic composition of Australian industry, of course, is apart from financial services, is, you know, bulky commodities, and you need few people to handle those bulky commodities, which represent a large amount of export revenue. And we don't really have a brand, we don't have branded products. So, it's very difficult, therefore, for a number of companies to be exporting from Australia to export in Japan, because essentially we're more in the wholesale end of the market rather than the retail end of the market. And lastly, I think we have a bunch of long-term Australians, talented Australians, who are running the Australian companies in Japan. There's actually no, and I think Jason touched on this, there's no real critical mass. I mean, you know, I've been going up there for, I don't know, 40 years or whatever, and nothing's really changed. When I say no critical mass, the Americans are absolute masters at networking the group and getting everyone to, you know, for the common good. And as Jason mentioned, Australians, you know, we've got this larrikin individualistic spirit, which is great. We just need to harness it. But as a result of that, I believe that one of the factors that has been limiting Australian companies is everyone's doing their own thing. They do come together, They know the embassy people in Australia and all the rest of it, but there's no critical mass there. And you need critical mass to suck in more companies and more people. There's no information flow out of Tokyo to the general Australian business community, which would even pique their interest, to go to Japan and have a look at the market opportunity.
Just before Jared opens the floor, Carlos, and your observations from the startup space, what could Australian startups do better going to Japan?
Going to Japan. Well, I think we need to let them know what's in Japan first. I think Australian startup doesn't know that market exists in Japan. So first of all, we need to raise awareness. We cannot do it by ourselves. We need a support from corporate and a government, obviously, but we need to let them know what you can do in Japan, what's beneficial for you to go in Japan. So before we know what they can do, for example, architect field, like we use exactly same technology, solving a little bit different problem. I've been talking to some of the people that's easily converted into the specific market. So Australian people start looking at Japan, finding what exactly problem we have in Japan. I think they can modify what they're already doing to match up Japan market. But we need to let them know what's in Japan first. So I think that's what we have to start doing.
Thank you.
I think, sorry, just to add to that, I mean, I think it benefits when you've got an ability or a structure in place that helps sort of facilitate us towards that that requirement quickly. And this is something that Bob does very, very well. And, let me use Stephen Chobo's example from last year, right? I mean, Japan, Abe said, we want to be the global leaders of regenerative medicine, but they're not good at early science technology, right? Australia's very good at early science technology, but not so good at regenerative medicine. So actually, people, come with me together and match them, and things happen as a consequence. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a thoughtful application of the complements that exist in an area that actually needs it, right? So I definitely don't say just go to Japan, because I think being thoughtful and kind of be relevant and help sort of guide people towards the outcome is the best way to do it. I just encourage us to be able to find a way to do that more frequently.
And that collaboration or complementarity can be spurred on by you as future leaders.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you all. I might open it up to the audience. I'm happy to take questions in Sydney, but I might even start actually in Tokyo. We've seen you on the screen there. Any questions in Tokyo? Just unmute your audio.
Just press the button on your microphone there in the center of the table.
No questions?
I might go first.
That's fine.
Natalie McDowell, I'm the co-chair together with Kanami Hara from the Macquarie Capital and Jorge Tamura of Rio Tinto there in Tokyo, of the AJPCC Future Leaders Group. I think it's been drawn up really well from the valuable comments of everyone here that there's a clear knowledge gap on both sides, despite all the efforts that are being made by the AJPCC, by with the New South Wales government, by all of the people, including Innovation Dojo, that on the Japanese side of things, there's a lot of capital looking for new ideas to invest in. But when you look at Australia, the image of Australia is not that it's an innovation leader, despite the fact that it is. Actually, Jason recently released a report showing that Australia and Japan are actually operating at a very high level in terms of incremental innovations and new ideas applying, for example, technology to the mining industry to be able to do autonomous mining, drone applications for agriculture, fintech, payment solutions, that sort of thing. So it's there in Australia. When looking at it from Japan, there's a knowledge gap. On the Australian end of things, it's been really well highlighted here that Australians think they know what Japan is about and have perceptions that it's an opaque market, whereas it is actually like any other market in the world. It has a structure, it has challenges, it has opportunities. You can identify the players and how they operate. That knowledge gap on both sides could be quite easily filled, you would think, and we're all doing things to achieve that. If you can
fill that knowledge gap, then that actually achieves our objectives as well as future leaders, because we want to see the relationship to continue to grow and expand and become more and more diverse. So in addition to what is being done in all of our organisations here, what is the solution to provide this platform to plug the knowledge gap? Forums like this are really valuable because we transfer the knowledge that senior people have and we share our own knowledge amongst us. But how do we, is there a simple platform that we need where people can go and see at one glance what the Japanese market looks like? Would that be a useful solution, or is there another solution?
Simple question, probably not a very simple answer. David, do you have a go at that?
Natalie, this may not answer your question, however, I think it's a method. And I think one of the things that we really miss in Australia is actually getting young Japanese interns to work in Australian companies. And I think through that process, it's osmotic. I'm afraid it's long term. This is not a quick fix. But it's the way that both employees and management will come to grips with, Japan. And so, we send off our young people under the new Colombo plan to Japan, and we have many Australians who've gone to Japan and then come back. They want to do something with Japan, but there's no job opportunity. There's no job pathway. So my suggestion is that what we need to do is to somehow or other develop up a system where we can get Japanese interns working here, even for a month, so that management and companies can sort of start to understand, you're from Japan, tell me about skiing or whatever, and through that they might then develop an interest. I think that's the way it's got to be, people to people, and of course then at the high level, at the top level, well, you could do the business deals, and PwC and the Minters of this world are, bringing deals together, for management. But you need to develop, I think, this as well. So we just don't have a high exposure of Japanese within the business community here in Australia.
Kaoru-san, do you have any other comments on that?
Sure. So I think that's definitely a great idea. And the corporate level, that's something they can do. I think my opinion is we need to increase the bottom line of Australian image in Japan. So I've been claiming that tourism is one way. There's so many ways to change a perception, but one way is the tourism, because the number of people who come to Australia from Japan became half last 20 years. So some of the perception is Australia is about nature. Australia is this. Mm-hmm. So they kind of fixed perception. So for them to change that, they need to experience it. So they need to come here and experience a different type of Australia. That's going to change the entire perception about Australia. You never know who's going to become an entrepreneur. You never know who's going to become a corporate executive in the future. But if they have that experience all the time, Australia actually a country like this, one point when they come to in the position to make a decision to go abroad, let's go to Australia because I know Australia is this. Because at this moment, because of that, a lot of people, before I moved here, a lot of people stopped me moving to Australia without knowing much, because they said they don't have much business there. But that's wrong, completely wrong perception. So for me to be able to change that, I have to start from increase the bottom of that bottom-up image.
Can I add a little bit? Also, for the Australian companies, it's important, and also important for Japanese companies to change their structure. There are so many experts coming to Australia from Japanese company every 2 years, 3 years. So I believe there are so many businessmen who have experience of working in Australia, in Japan. But those, because of the Japanese company structure, those people, when they go back to Japan, they normally go to a different section. They won't deal with any Australian business anymore. But those are really important resources to develop the Australian-Japan community and business relationship. So I think Japanese companies also need to change the structure.
Yeah, that's a good point. Bob, do you have a question or
no,
a comment on that?
No, just a response. Firstly, can I just say how how pleased I am to see this event. I wish that us old people would have a similar discussion to this, because all the issues that were raised here are really important, and the insights that have come from this group are fantastic. I'm also pleased to see that we have some old people here mixed amongst this group, and also that the women have definitely outshone the men here. Now, Natalie asked a question which people have sort of skirted around, which is, why aren't Australian companies coming to Japan and what do we do about it? First thing is, Kairi-san used the word perception, and I think that's actually much better than Natalie's formulation of a knowledge gap. There is a perception gap, and it goes both ways. And the perception comes from lack of knowledge, and it's the perception that we've got to change. Now, David mentioned something. It's actually a really complex problem. We don't have any journalists in Japan that report, Australian journalists anymore that report on here. So the information that we get here for the business community is very, very limited. So there's got to be a whole series of things done to try and change the perception. And I think Oyen-san mentioned the perception that Japan is an ageing society, it's a shrinking society, the economy's struggling. And you know, you see numbers like 1% growth in GDP. People don't understand that that 1% is despite a shrinking population, and 30% of the energy was knocked out during the Tohoku earthquake. So it's an incredible number.
Yeah.
But this is part of the knowledge which will change the perception. I think the HABCC is doing a number of things where we get senior business leaders coming down here and holding lunches and dinners where they can actually talk to the Australian counterparts. The Japanese know Australia better than we do, and that's the reason that Jason's numbers are so impressive. They're the largest investor group here. We don't have to tell them anything, at least in the senior levels. It's the other way around where the problem comes. And so there's got to be a multiple level of solutions to this.
Yeah.
And part of it is, as we've been talking here, is everywhere we go, we just need to start trying to change that perception. And it was interesting, the Premier of New South Wales, when she spoke to some of the Japanese companies who are trying to invest here, she said, the reason I want to deal with you is because we share common values. We have similar philosophies. We can trust you. Now, these are all things that Australian businesses need to understand.
Yes.
They go anywhere in the world, they are not going to get a similar relationship that they do with Japanese. And these are messages. I mean, there's got to be multiple ways of doing it, but it's really important, because unless we change that perception, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate that. We've probably got some time for maybe one or two more questions here or in Melbourne. Any questions down in Melbourne? Or back in Sydney?
Can you hear?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi everyone, Matthew here in Melbourne. Thank you very much to everyone in Sydney. What a great seminar and presentation. Just wanted to pick up on something Bob mentioned just then, with the involvement of the New South Wales government. We've seen government reach the Japan-Australia Economic Partnership Agreement. We've seen the TPP. We're seeing a lot of high-level contact between Australia and Japan. Is government doing enough? Do they need to do more? Or is it really up to the business community now to step up? Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Anyone have got that question?
Oh, without doubt, it's got to be a nationalistic approach to solving this problem. You know, we can't rely on government to solve problems. I mean, you know, whether that's, you know, relationships with other countries or stuff that's needed to be done in Australia to help sort of solve some societal issues, et cetera. I mean, everybody needs to realise that there's a role to be played, and you know, we need to absolutely engage. You know, there are a lot of programs, and sort of continuing with Bob's sort of line of thinking. I mean, the Australian government's got the Australia Now initiative that's currently, you know, going on in Japan, which is about showcasing Australia to Japan. A lot of the focus is hospitality and leisure, music, sport, food, etc., which is fantastic. But I think don't stop there. Keep going, but equally, let's get corporates, academics involved in saying to the government, that's fantastic, but next time, next iteration, can we do this and can we have a go and so on and so forth, to sort of turn that start into a snowball that sort of continues to evolve and morph into helping us solve some of these problems and these perception gaps that exist. So absolutely, you know, we've all got a role to play. You know, the corporates that are in Japan, the likes of the ANZ banks, Goodman's, they're doing a great job. They're doing their fair share, but we need more corporates back here. We need the professional services firms. You know, we need wonderful institutions like Innovation Dojo to sort of all keep chipping in, but let's do it collaboratively, not individualistic, because that's not going to help.
Anyone else on the panel want to comment on that, or we?
I'd just briefly like to say that, you know, the infrastructure, the inverted commas, the human infrastructure between Australia and Japan on the bilateral is probably the best of any bilateral relationship that Australia has. So there's lots of organisations that play in the space, right? And I think, you know, on that basis, that actually government needs to do what it's doing. But I agree with Jason that basically, you know, it's up to the corporates to sort of step up to the to the plate, and maybe there is an issue as to if we can get all of the existing infrastructure, which does tend to operate pretty much siloed, but maybe you know, if we can get them actually coordinating, as Jason is sort of suggesting, maybe that will be a good result.
Well, I think we could probably talk about these issues all afternoon, I think, but I'm conscious we all have our day jobs to get back to this afternoon, and it's Friday afternoon, so I might draw time on the seminar now. As we draw to a close, can I just, on behalf of the AJBCC Future Leaders, extend a sincere vote of thanks to each of you for making yourselves firstly available and sharing your thoughts and experiences on today's numerous topics. I'm sure you'll agree that we've all heard some really interesting things here and some really interesting takeaways for us that will help us in developing and guiding our relationship with Australia and Japan. So as a token of thanks, we have a small gift for each of you. And can I please ask the audience here and around the offices to thank the panellists. I also thank each of you for coming today. We really, really do enjoy putting these seminars on, and I'm really thrilled with the turnout that we've had. I think it's a record for Sydney for sure. So thank you so much, and I appreciate you all making yourselves available today. Can I also just thank my fellow organisers, Peter and Matthew down there in Melbourne, for pulling this together this afternoon. There's been a lot of things going on in the background to get this together. I think it's really ran very smoothly, so thank you to both of you. I'll just hand over to Natalie quickly at the end. Matt just wants to say a few words about what's happening coming up, both within our group but also broadly for the conference in October.
Thanks, Dr. Lewis, and thank you to the seminar group team for preparing this event. It's been fantastic. It's actually part of an ongoing series of seminars, and we have another one planned in August.
Yes, of course.
So if you're interested or you know others who are interested in the work that we're doing, please keep an eye out for the invite to that event. And the largest piece of work that we do is actually at the conference each year, the joint conference of the AJBCC and the JBCC. That's occurring on the 14th and 16th of October in Sydney, which makes it easy for Australian-based future leaders to attend. So if you are interested in joining that session, we have a round table where we speak with senior leaders about the conversation that we've been having here, and we present a plenary session to the conference of 400 leaders from Japan and Australia at the conference. Please be in contact with us if you are able to attend, and we'd very much welcome that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nat.